Hello, and welcome to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies.
Welcome to the latest Oxford Institute for Energy Studies podcast. My name is David Ledesma, and I'm chairman of the Natural Gas Programme at the Institute. It's my great pleasure to be joined today by Philip Andrew Speed, who's Senior Principal Fellow at the Energy Studies Institute of the National University of Singapore, to discuss his recently published energy insight, Does 2020 Mark a Critical Juncture in China's Low-Carbon Energy Transition?, that he co-authored with Sufang Zhang and Zhao Wang from the School of Economics and Management, North China Electricity Power University. Philip, great to have you here.
And it's good to be with you, David.
Philip, I read your paper, which I found absolutely fascinating, but let's start off by talking about in the context of China's 2060 carbon neutrality pledge. It would seem rather obvious that 2020 is a critical juncture in China's low carbon transition. So why is it an open question or research issue at the moment?
Well, we started working on this paper in the second quarter of 2020, and at that stage, nothing was obvious. Many around the world were saying it was a global opportunity for countries to accelerate the low carbon energy transition. But what we saw in China did not match this. The economic recovery packages did not emphasize this. Rather, it focused on employment and social stability. And there was no grand announcement of a green recovery like the EU had made. And at first sight, it looked like more of the same.
So when thinking about 2020 then, what would a critical juncture look like? And what are, let's say, the three trends or outcomes that could be possible?
Well, you know, in today's world, the positive one would be a strong green recovery that emphasized energy and material efficiency, renewable energy, and tight constraints on fossil fuels. At the other extreme, such a strategy would involve an emphasis on self-reliance in energy, more fossil fuels, and heavy investment in traditional infrastructure. Or the third would be a sort of business as usual, with progress along the low-carbon energy transition continuing as before.
So before kind of discussing the future trends, let's look back. Because in your paper, you discuss Li Qiang's 2019 comments where he argued China should make better use of its domestic resources of coal, oil, and natural gas to enhance national security of energy supply. So could you perhaps share with us what was the backdrop or the context of the statement, and how did COVID-19 impact on the coal sector?
Well, you know, for a couple of years, the tensions between China and the USA have been building up. And that, even without COVID, would have been a driver to the reversion to emphasizing self-reliance. But this preference for self-reliance has always been there in the background, back to the days of Mao. You know, coal is lots of it. It's relatively cheap. It continues to play a major role in the energy mix, though it's declining slowly. But coal production in the first half of 2020 was actually higher than the first half of 2019, despite the suspension of production in many coal mines for a couple of months. And earlier, also in February of 2020, the government gave permission for a large number of coal-fired power plants to go ahead with construction of new plants. And also, the number of coal-to-chemical plants is growing to produce petrochemicals from coal.
So, this doesn't seem to match with the kind of the 2060 carbon neutrality pledge, does it?
Well, I mean, again, that's relatively recent. That's September. So, before September, yeah, it didn't look very green. Absolutely.
So how would you characterize China's post-COVID-19 recovery package? You know, what have been the kind of the main trends, macro and, say, energy policies?
Well, as I said, if you just read the plans as they're written, they're not notably green. There's still a heavy reliance on energy-intensive industries, steel and cement, emphasis, as I said, on self-reliance in energy. And the Eurasia Group did a study a few months ago that estimated that although the amount of money directed at green projects is double that devoted to brown projects, the life cycle carbon emissions from all of the projects will be positive. So if you put them all together, they estimated a few months ago that actually there'll be more emissions than there would have been without the recovery package.
So which areas has the recovery package focused on then? Because you note that they aren't new and not particularly green. So why is that?
Well, I mean, you know, poverty reduction and agriculture were key parts of the recovery plan. But then there was investment in what they called new infrastructure. And, you know, the new bit of that was sort of what they called information infrastructure, 5G, internet, data centers, etc. Then there's what they called integrative infrastructure, which was ultra-high voltage transmission that they already have, batteries they're already working on, charging stations for electric vehicles or whatever. And then innovative infrastructure, which is building the institutional infrastructure to assist innovation, technological innovation. But of course, all that's very state-driven. And then there was the urban renewal, which is all about buildings and local infrastructure, very traditional. And then a lot of stuff like railways, which again is just more of the same, and the whole issue of energy security.
Yeah, it's interesting because, of course, energy security is so key, and particularly after kind of the disruptions we've seen in 2020. But can you talk about the elements of continuity versus change in China's approach to energy policy in the wake of the COVID-19 pandemic?
Well, until September, it felt very much like more of the same, or potentially a step back with this self-reliance in energy. And then came Xi Jinping's announcements in September that the country would aim for carbon neutrality by 2060. But, you know, that's why we started this paper that was completed before Xi Jinping's announcement, really, or just before, it was a question. But I think it is still a question.
But how have changes in the macroeconomic outlook informed energy policy choices, have they?
Well, if we go back to when Xi Jinping arrived as president in 2012 and 13, you know, he's pushed a new normal that says, yeah, we need to slow down the economy. We can't be investing forever in energy-intensive industries. So the economy has slowed down from 10, 12, 13% a year to 6% a year before the pandemic. And this has helped to raise the share of non-fossil fuel in the energy mix, not just because they've been investing in non-fossil fuel, but because coal is the swing fuel. But the trouble is, energy use continues to rise, coal use continues to rise, and carbon emissions continue to rise. So the future, in many ways, the future of the energy mix will depend greatly on economic growth and economic structure, as much as it does on energy policy.
Now, you note in your paper in particular that COVID-19 will result in a deeper involvement of the state in the economy. Now, what does that tell us about the role and power of the state energy companies? And does that help or hinder the energy transition in China?
Well, the state and the party have been getting increasingly involved in the economy and in state-owned enterprises and private enterprises since 2013. Much of this is politically motivated, but there's also a stated desire for state-owned enterprises to be better managed and be more commercially oriented. But in the energy sector, this is in tension with the self-reliance preference, at least when it comes to coal, oil, and gas. So you want to dig more coal, oil, and gas, particularly oil and gas. It's not cheap. Therefore, how are you going to be commercial? And if you want to produce more coal, how are you going to move to a low-carbon economy? Of course, renewable energy and nuclear, combined with energy efficiency, also support self-reliance.
So before we talk about energy security again, I'd like to refer to something you, in your paper, you talk about the six stabilities and six guarantees. You know, perhaps you could share with our listeners what they are.
Well, the stabilities and the guarantees are sort of linked, so I won't go through 12 things. I'll go through the six stabilities. It's about employment and you know, keeping people employed, earning money is almost the top priority for the government because that's social stability. Managing the financial sector properly. And we've seen that in the last week or so with the treatment of the Ant IPO. foreign trade. Yeah, we want to keep foreign trade going. We want foreign investment where we need it, but particularly we want domestic investment. Yeah, and we want to keep the market going, and we want local government working efficiently. So it's a sort of wish list, but it's interesting that employment is at the top, and in the guarantees, job security, basic livelihoods are at the top. And also in the guarantees is food and energy security. So there are some very conservative things in these key six stabilities and six guarantees.
And I imagine that these have grown even more important since the COVID-19 pandemic and the whole question of supply chains of goods. Energy security must have risen up the importance of the list, as indeed all these other stabilities and guarantees have, haven't they?
Yes. Again, because of the combination of the COVID pandemic with the tensions with the USA and other countries like Australia.
So how does energy security fit in the government's priorities and thinkings, therefore, and what actions have been actually taken to enhance it?
Well, security of energy supply has always been the top priority for energy policy in China, regardless of what people say. And secondary policies have been access to energy, particularly under Mao. He was very keen under that. And again, in the 80s and 90s, access to energy for poorer people was very important. More recently, air pollution has become important. And I put in brackets, and climate change. So that's what I would see as the order of priority in general. And that means domestically for security supply, that means more oil, more gas, neither of which are cheap to produce in China these days, more coal, which is cheap for polluting, more nuclear, which is expensive, and more renewables. At the same time, they continue to build oil and gas import pipelines from the near abroad in mainland Eurasia, and we're expecting the announcement of a second Siberian pipeline, and also these overseas foreign direct investment and loans for oil in more remote countries have been part of this energy security package. But I think the government has now learned that this isn't terribly useful unless it's, again, in the near abroad where the oil or gas can be brought in by pipe.
So how have renewables fared in the post-COVID-19 recovery? And is that a departure from the goals set out in the 13th plan?
Well, the share, if we just look at the third quarter of 2020, after when the economy started picking up again, then the share of non-fossil fuels, including hydro, in the electricity mix in the third quarter of this year was 33.1%, up from 31.3%. So if you're looking at the actual mix, non-fossil fuels are up, including hydro and nuclear. Wind and solar were up from 7.2% to 8%. So this reflects not only new capacity having been constructed at the end of last year, but also better enforcement of the dispatch rules. But it's not dramatic, given the drop in actual power consumption. Investment in new wind and solar installations slowed in the first half of the year, obviously due to supply chain problems, but it's now picking up, especially for offshore wind.
So how does the carbon neutrality pledge then fit in with the picture you've just painted?
Well, this pledge, if fully implemented, would seem to represent an acceleration of recent trends in China's low carbon energy transition. But, and this is more recent, announcement earlier this week, there still might be a tension with Xi Jinping's pledge to double the GDP by 2035.
So what are, therefore, the main challenges associated with achieving a net zero carbon by 2060? And how is the pledge and the challenges informing the priorities of the 14th plan? Because the power sector reform seems to be a key element in the energy transition, but you argue in the paper that the role of the state is reinforced. And therefore, how will that impact on the power sector reform and roll out the carbon emissions trading market? There's a lot of questions in that, Philip, but perhaps you could kind of share with our listeners your views.
Well, I think first, and this is a commonly shared problem or question, is how do you define and measure net zero? You know, it's not just energy, but it's also other sources of greenhouse gases and carbon, carbon sinks such as soil, forest, and ocean. So this the net zero pledge does not mean that the energy sector will be net zero. I think this is very important in any country. On the 14th five-year plan, I think it'll be difficult to completely reorientate the plan radically in the short time available before the middle end of next year. Because there needs to be quite careful consideration and discussion of the options available and to get the key actors, different ministries, provincial governments, and state-owned enterprises on side. So I think we should probably wait a while before we see the plans that would actually show that the Chinese are going to follow through. I think the 14th five-year plan may not give enough indication that this is going to be achieved. The power sector reform, I mean, this is a tricky one. I mean, for the past 30 years, the government has relied on administrative or command and control instruments. You know, do this or you're in trouble. And it's actually worked quite well. But as Zhang Shufeng and I have documented elsewhere, it's very difficult to get the state in China out of the electricity market, either at national level or at local level, let alone ownership of the state-owned enterprises. So, yeah, the developing a truly competitive power market will take a long time and a lot of political capital to be deployed and some bold decisions. And this affects two things, not only price, but dispatch. Okay, so you've got these two things that are highly political at national or local level. And the same issues are likely to constrain the effectiveness of the national carbon market as well. So you've got they're introducing two markets at the same time into a sector where the state has a lot of vested interest.
And so we really have to wait and see how that's going to play out, don't we, Philip?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's too early to tell. There are too many contradictions. You've got the self-reliance in energy. You've got the state-owned enterprises have to be commercial. We're going to double the GDP by 2035, and we're going to have carbon neutrality by 2060. And so I think we have to wait and go back to the research question. I mean, critical junctures generally only become apparent after the event. So, you know, come back in 5-10 years' time, and we can review the progress.
Yeah, because as you said, you know, we have covered a lot of subjects in the kind of the last 20 minutes discussion. And, you know, I think the title of your paper, you know, does 2020 mark a critical juncture in China's low carbon energy transition is a good one. But the answer sounds to me, maybe. Is that the case?
Absolutely. I mean, yeah, say come back in 10 years time and we can review and decide, was it a critical juncture or was it a juncture that became critical or was it a juncture that did not become critical.
So that means we've got to put a date in the diary for a podcast in 10 years, does it, Philip?
Yes, I look forward to it.
Well, look, Philip, thank you very much for your time. You know, as always, you know, I enjoy our conversations. And Philip's paper, which we've said several times, does 2020 mark a critical juncture in China's low-carbon energy transition, can be found at our website. And, you know, I hope you have all enjoyed listening to this podcast. Thank you and goodbye to everyone.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies. You can find other podcasts, as well as all our written research, on our website at www.oxfordenergy.org. If you would like more details about our oil, gas, electricity, or China programmes, then please contact us at information@oxfordenergy.org.